Welcome to episode 24 of the Help Side Basketball Coaching Strategy and Analytics Podcast. I am your host, John Jansen, head men's basketball coach at La Sierra University, located here in Riverside, California. We come to you this week, a couple weeks after an amazing Lakers championship. And, you know, I decided to wait a couple weeks before the podcast because I like to take some time and process everything that happened, think about it, and kind of see what the consequences are and what's going to happen moving forward for both teams because of what happened in the finals. So I always do like to wait before getting into that. So today on the podcast, we are going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the NBA championship, the Lakers winning, and what that means for individuals, what that means for the two teams, etc. In the analytics section, we're going to talk about sponsorship. And by sponsorship, I don't mean money sponsorship. I mean having someone go to bat for you when that time comes. And in the strategy session, we are going to talk about getting an advantage coming off a ball screen. And this is something that we're putting into our offense this year. And it's really important for us to be able to come off these ball screens and create an advantage through the ball screen. So let's get right into it. The first thing I want to do is tell you about how my team's doing so far. We are beginning our third week of practice, and we have seven new guys, and so far I'd say it's going pretty good. Like I said, we're putting in a new offense, which is going to take some time. And with a bunch of new guys, it definitely is an adjustment period. And with a bunch of new junior college guys, I kind of think that junior college guys don't play a ton of defense. So we're kind of getting those guys caught up right now and learning to play the defense the way that I want it to be played. Right now, we're still not allowed to play any games yet. And we're hoping to get an answer on when and if we can play this semester on November 1st. So at this point, we're just practicing. And they told us from the beginning that we might just be practicing through, you know, our Christmas break, which is December 11th, and we might not get to play at all. And we might be approved to play, and we might start getting to play a week from now. So it's really still up in the air. We're hoping we want to play. You know, we hope that all this practice we're doing is going to mean something for us, and we're hoping that we get it to play. Now, as far as some people have been asking me how COVID testing has been going, we have COVID testing on our campus every 2 weeks. Every athlete, actually every person who comes on the campus, is required to be tested every 2 weeks, and the test takes about 72 hours to go through. So we get tested on Mondays and Tuesdays every other week, and we know by, you know, Thursday or Friday, and those last for 2 weeks. And moving forward into November, we should be getting tested an additional 2 times a week. So I've heard that a lot of different conferences in California are very close to canceling all their sports, and that's because of the cost of the COVID tests. And, you know, you think to yourself, well, these schools make lots of money, and why wouldn't they just fork out the money for that? It's not just the price. It's the fact that it's very possible that we could hit this pandemic worse than last year or the same as last year, and sports will all get shut down again. And now you've invested all this money and you don't even get to play the sport. So I think that's why a lot of schools are saying, hey, you know, let's hold off this year and hopefully pick it up back next year when hopefully there's a vaccine or some kind of easier way to test, a cheaper way to test next year. Moving on to the NBA Finals. So look, we all knew that the Lakers were a huge favorite going into the finals, and it really, to me, seemed like the best possible matchup for the Lakers with the final few teams that were left. I think the Lakers were better than Boston, but I think Boston could do some things that the Lakers would struggle with. And I just thought Miami's lack of size would really hurt them. And Miami plays good defense, not amazing defense. They didn't have superstars to guard the Lakers superstars. And I thought, even if, you know, you kind of cancel out Butler and LeBron, and even a little bit, Bam Adebayo and Anthony Davis, I still felt that the Lakers' other role players were better players on both ends of the floor than Miami. So I just felt that the Lakers were better in just about every aspect. And I give a lot of credit to the Heat. I mean, they really battled. The first game that Butler basically won on his own was really impressive. It kind of reminded me of LeBron against, you know, Golden State a few years ago when he had that team that was all injured and he won that game. I think it might have been game one in overtime on the road. And he basically took the team on his back and did everything. And I think Butler's status has gone way up. You know, Butler's always been a good player and a really good defender and a decent offensive player. But he has really, really elevated his offensive game with Miami. And I know part of it had to do with some other guys being injured and him having to do more. But he also showed he can do it. You know, he's never been this high-scoring guy. He's always been an above-average scorer and then just a guy who does everything. And he took on the lead role, and he really was really impressive. And he also was able to get other guys involved, too. You know, a lot of guys, when they switch to a more scoring role, that's all they do. And he was really able to, you know, rack up assists and get his teammates involved. So I was really impressed with him and just Miami in general. And, you know, thinking about game five, the one that Miami won, I'm going to go conspiracy theory here. Because if you guys remember down the stretch, and I know it's been a few weeks now, but if you remember down the stretch, both teams were alternating buckets in the last 2 minutes of the game. The Lakers would score, and then Miami would score, and then the Lakers would score, and I think LeBron hit a couple shots in a row. Well, that's all fine, but the thing was that it seemed to me that Miami got to the free throw line down the stretch basically every possession, and especially the very last possession. So I think LeBron hit a shot to give the Lakers the lead with like 16 seconds left. And Miami takes the ball, gives it to Jimmy Butler. He dribbles to the hoop, jumps into Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis looked like he was very vertical. And they call a foul. And Anthony and Butler goes to the line and makes two free throws to give them the lead. And to me, look, I don't know what goes on behind the scenes at the NBA, but I do know this. What that did, not only Miami winning, but just giving him those two free throws, set up the kind of finish that the NBA wants, right? So here's what you have. You have Miami taking the lead with whatever it was, 10 seconds left, or I don't remember how many seconds left, but not under one possession left. Miami has a lead by one. So now what are you going to do? You're going to get LeBron to hit, or Anthony Davis hit a game-winning shot to end the NBA Finals, which is great. Or the Lakers don't score, and now you get another game, which is more viewers, more money, you know, more advertising, all that other stuff. So I don't want to say outright that I think the refs gave the game to Miami, but I do believe that there was some part of it that wanted Miami to win, or in that last scenario, put the onus on LeBron to win the game. So that if he didn't, we have another game. And if he did, like I said, we have a great walk-off victory for the Lakers. So I was pretty upset as a Laker fan the way that thing played out. And I just think that the league wanted another game. So I was disappointed with that. And then, of course, in game six, the Lakers come out and destroy them. And it wasn't even a game. And you know what? As a coach, and those of you who are coaches, which is probably pretty much everyone, this is what we want. You know, if you were a Laker fan, a real Laker fan, this is the kind of game we wanted. We did not want a close game. We wanted them to, you know, as a coach, you, everyone thinks, oh, it's not exciting if you blow a team out by 30. For as a coach, you don't care. You just want to win the game. And if you don't even have to worry about it and you're up by 30 the whole game, then that's even better because there's no stress. You don't have to think about it. It makes the coaching decisions easy. And it's like the ideal way to win a game. So for most viewers, it was probably quite boring. And I know the ratings were low, but as coaches and Laker and me as a Laker fan, I thought it was great. I find it very interesting how, you know, in the two losses the Lakers had, they came out so flat. And I know that it's human nature that the team behind is going to play harder because they're desperate, and the team ahead is going to be relaxed a little bit because they know that they have, you know, that cushion. But I mean, it was so obvious those two games they lost from the tip that the Lakers just weren't into it. You know, Anthony Davis was so weak in those couple games. And I know the first one, they double teamed him every time, but he turned the ball over. I mean, it's not even like he was passing the ball out of double teams well. It's almost like it's scripted. I know it's not, but it's so weird when the Lakers would come out flat like that. You know, and it happened a few times in the playoffs where they just came out flat and you could just tell from the opening few minutes of the game that they probably weren't going to win because they just didn't have the edge. And then after they would lose the game, they come out and they just killed guys. And it's just like, why? I just don't understand it, you know, especially in the finals. You know, I get it maybe in the early rounds when you know you're going to win the series and maybe your body isn't feeling great that day. And so you kind of take the, you know, take a night where you don't go super hard or something. But when you get to the NBA finals, each game is so important because, I mean, this is history, you know. Nobody remembers if you get eliminated in the first round or the second round. But if you lose in the finals, I mean, you never hear the end of it. So, and even how many games you win in, people count these days. So it was a little disappointing that they didn't come out and sweep them or you know, take care of business easier. But I understand that when you get to that stage that everyone's playing hard and you know, the Miami's going to go as hard as they can because they know they're the underdog. So, but at the end of the day, they got it done. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter how many games it goes, but I'm happy they got it done. I'm happy for LeBron. You know, every time he wins a championship, he inches that much closer. Well, I think he's already in the lead, but, you know, these Jordan people will never, it doesn't really matter. The Jordan people are never going to change their mind. So, but let's talk about LeBron and AD in the finals. I mean, LeBron is just so amazing at his age, you know, leading this team with both his offense, his defense, his assists, you know, his scoring. And whenever Anthony Davis was down, he took over and he carried that team. And it was just amazing to see. And I'm so impressed and I'm so sad. Every time I watch him, I get a little sad knowing that there's just no way it's going to last forever. And when it goes, everyone's just going to jump on him because that's what people do, you know, in this social media era. And it's just so impressive. And let me tell you something. If you're a LeBron James hater, number one, probably we won't be friends because you just don't understand greatness. And number two, if you're a LeBron James hater, you know, someone told me this about this a long time ago, not about LeBron, I don't even remember who it was about, but they said, if you're able to witness greatness and you should just never hate that person because you're going to miss out on all these amazing moments and all these amazing performances because of your hate, because of your dislike and whatever reason that is. You know, if you see someone who's great, you should appreciate it and take it in and enjoy it because it's not going to last forever. And we're not going to see a LeBron very soon. And, you know, I mean, I can't imagine he can do this for five more years, but who knows? People said that 5 years ago, you know? So I'm just so impressed with him. As far as Anthony Davis, you know, he's, you know, it's so funny because when he would play on the Pelicans, he would just have these monster 40-20 games or 40, 15, and 10 games. And when you see him as a Laker, yes, has dominant times, but he's not a dominating player. You know, he's not a guy that you can give him the ball and he could get you a bunch of buckets in a row. You know, he could get you a bucket here and a bucket there, but really the buckets he's getting you, they're usually fallaways. They're post-ups where he just shoots over the guy. He's not aggressive one-on-one. And then a lot of times he you know, requires someone to get him the ball. You know, LeBron or Caruso or Rondo would drive to the hoop and Anthony Davis would cut in behind and get an easy dunk. And that's fantastic. I mean, that's great. But he's not that kind of traditional superstar that, you know, when you think about the superstars throughout the years that you just could just get their own shot and get their own bucket all whenever they wanted to. And I still, you know, he's a finesse player, and I don't think he would deny that. I don't think he would be offended by being called that. That's just the way his game is, and it's just a little different. And you might immediately say, well, Tim Duncan was a finesse player, but that means you're remembering the Tim Duncan from the last 4 to 5 years of his career. You're not remembering the early Tim Duncan that would just go down and dunk on you. You know, you're remembering 40-year-old Tim Duncan who would shoot these little weird jump hooks with the wrong hand in front over the guys, or he would, you know, turn and try to draw and jump under a guy and draw a foul. You know, that was a guy who had lost his athleticism and was just trying to get by. You know, when he was young, he would dominate guys and he would go to the hoop and he would dunk on them. And look, Anthony Davis dunks on people sometimes too, but in general, I think we could agree he's more of a passive player. And that's great. And that works great with the Lakers. The question is, when LeBron is gone, can Anthony Davis take over that number one role and be a guy who carries a franchise? And I'm not sure if the answer is yes yet. And look, who knows? I mean, by that time, the Lakers may get Dame Lillard. They may get, I mean, who knows? They could get anybody. So we don't have to worry about that yet. But I'm just saying, I don't know if Anthony Davis is the guy that can carry a franchise on his back by himself. The last thing I want to talk about with this is what this means for the teams moving forward. And I'll start with the Miami Heat. And I know Pat Riley has said that they're pretty good. You know, they're pretty set with who they have and they think they can make another run in it. And I'm not sure if that's it, if that's the truth. You know, they were the 5 seed. And, you know, when was the last time a 5 seed made it to the NBA Finals? It's been a long time. It's usually the top couple seeds. And I think part of the fact that there was no home crowd, I think part of the fact that there was a big layoff contributed to all of that. And I do think the East was down this year. There's no doubt about it. I think Milwaukee was definitely down because they lost a score. I think obviously Toronto, even though we didn't think they were down without Kawhi. And even Boston was good, but you know, even when they were losing to Miami, they did not play Brad Stevens basketball. It was one-on-one, my turn, your turn, my turn, your turn. It wasn't move the ball, drive and kick, come off a ball screen, all that kind of stuff that he's known for, where his offense flowed. It was give the ball to one guy, let him go to work, and the next possession, and like that. And it's not the way that was maximizing the role players, because the role players never touched the ball. They'd stand in the corner, and occasionally someone would kick the ball out to them, and they were expected to make a shot. When they would go 3, 4, 5 possessions without literally even touching the ball. So I think the East was significantly down. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. So, I mean, look, you have the Nets coming with Kyrie and Durant next year, and I think some of these teams that lost big pieces, like I just mentioned, will learn how to play with their roster, or we'll go out and sign free agents and add those pieces that they lost because they saw that it wasn't quite good enough. So I think the East is going to be tougher next year a little bit. Well, just having the Nets involved is going to make it tougher. And I just don't know if, as constructed, the Miami Heat's good enough to get back there, get back to the finals, let alone win the finals. And they're talking about going after Jeremy Grant from OKC, which I think would be a great pickup. Fantastic pickup, but I'm not sure if where they were lacking was at the 3, you know. I think more they need more of a guy like Bam, like another stretch 4 to give them the length, because they just didn't have the length and they didn't have the size to compete with a team like the Lakers. And I love what the Lakers did. You know, I didn't like it at first, but I love how the Lakers matched up size for size, and they said, well, we're more talented, so if we match up size for size, we're still better than you. And at first I was against it because I thought they're losing their edge because they had 2 bigs that couldn't be stopped. But then you think, well, they weren't you know, we're not getting a ton out of Dwight Howard. We're not getting anything out of JaVale McGee. So even though we're longer, we're giving up speed on defense, you know, and ball screen defense by having both of these big guys in the game. And so what they did is got one, rid of one of them, you know, took one out, and now they could match up better, and they were able to stay with, you know, the smaller, faster teams while still being more talented and still having an advantage. So I thought that was really good. So the Lakers moving forward, look, it's another year. I mean, they're not a young team. I mean, obviously there's young players, but Rondo's not young. LeBron's not young. JaVale's not young. Danny Green's not young. You know, Kuzma's pretty young. Caruso, who knows how old he is. He looks 40, but I think he's like 24. Dwight's old. So, you know, it's going to be interesting because these teams that are veteran teams win championships. But the Lakers are going to get the shortest break of any team besides for obviously Miami. And if they end up starting this thing in December, I mean, you're asking LeBron to get back up and go 70, 80 games after just getting done with a short break. And it scares me for injuries. It doesn't scare me for his production while he's playing. It scares me for injuries. And if he gets injured, the Lakers are done. So I would almost recommend having them play LeBron every other game, or, you know, play two or three games and sit out two or three games, something like that, to keep him rested and fresh for the whole year and hopefully keep the chance of injury down. And the same thing goes for some of these other guys. You know, I know the NBA lengthened out the season a couple of years ago so they wouldn't have to rest players like Pop used to do all the time. But for the Lakers, I think this is a rest season. I think this is a get into the playoffs as like the 3 or 4 seed and see what you can do. And you're going to have to win a game on the road if we're back in home arenas. But good teams can do that. And, you know, when the Lakers were winning their championships every year, they dropped down a seed because they knew they could do it. And other teams did the same thing. I think Miami might have done the same thing too when LeBron was there. They weren't the number one seed because they knew they could win a game on the road because they were such a veteran team. So I think that's what the Lakers will probably need to do. I still think they might need to add another piece or two. You know, they signed J.R. Smith, who's useless. They signed Waiters Island, who's worse than useless. Jared Dudley is useless. So that's 3 roster spots, and I don't know their contracts. I don't know how far they or how long they have them, but I would consider getting rid of those guys and getting some guys that are younger maybe and that can play some fill-in minutes when you're limiting LeBron's minutes and games, and maybe might be cheaper, you know, because that nucleus that they have is good enough to win a championship. And so those 3 or 4, you know, guys that don't really play are expendable. And so if you can, you know, bring in some younger, cheaper guys that can just give you some minutes, almost like pitchers when you just have an arm that can throw 200 innings and they go 10-8 or 8-8 or 10-10, and the coach doesn't care because you're just eating up innings. So if they could sign some young guys like that who can just eat up minutes and be okay, then that'd be great. But I really think that the Lakers should be the favorite next year. I mean, I think, you know, let's jump for a second to the Clippers. I don't think Tyronn Lue was the correct hire, and I don't think he's a bad coach, but I think they needed a really, really good technical coach to maximize that team. And, you know, look, I know Tyronn Lue's a player's coach, but, you know, that team's got a lot of personality on it, and they've got a ton of talent. And I was way more scared of them than I was of Denver. I thought the Clippers would beat the Lakers if they played each other. And they kind of just fell apart. And I think they need a coach to come in there and get this thing right and maximize talent. Maximize their talent. Because roster to roster, you probably say that they're way more talented than the Lakers. I mean, look, you can put Kawhi right there with LeBron and Paul George, who can the Lakers match? You know, Montrezl Harrell is a really good player. Zubac is just as good as JaVale, probably better than JaVale. Lou Williams is a beast. Beverly's great. I mean, Shamet. I mean, all these guys that they got are just really good players. And they're young, and they're way younger than the Lakers. And it just seems like they should be the team to beat. And so I think they should have gotten, I mean, look, they should have done what Boston did before. Trade for Brad Stevens, like they did for Doc Rivers. Trade for Eric Spoelstra, you know. Get Pop. Get somebody that can come in and win a championship. And I just don't know if Ty Lue's the guy. I think they're going to be good because they just have so much talent, but I don't know if he's the guy to get them over that Lakers hump or get them over that Denver hump that they haven't been able to get over basically since Doc got there. So I still think the Lakers are the favorite, but again, we're just adding another year to LeBron, and if it's a quick start, I don't know. We'll have to see, but I'm excited for it, and you know, hopefully the Lakers can at least make a deep run. So let's move on now to the analytics section, and I want to talk about sponsorship. And I listened to this great article on TED Talk, on TED Business Talk, and this lady talked about sponsorship. And I wanted to relate it to basketball because I think it's very, very similar. Because in all walks of life, all jobs, we need to have a sponsor. And like I said in the beginning, sponsorship has nothing to do with money. This kind of sponsorship is someone who goes to bat for you. And, you know, I had a team meeting with my players last night because I was unhappy with some things. And I talked about this. And in this TED Talk, this lady talked about who is going to go into the room and have your back and talk well about you. And it was a great point. And it was a really interesting TED Talk. It's probably the most recent one if you go on your app store. And as far as basketball, first let's talk about it from a player standpoint. And then we'll talk about it from a coach's standpoint. So when you're a player and you graduate high school or you graduate college and you're moving on to the next level, whether it be a high school player moving on to college basketball or a college player wanting to play overseas, wanting to get a job, whatever the case may be, you're going to need references. You're going to need letters of rec. And when people ask you for these letters of rec or have someone make a phone call on your behalf, a phone call recommendation, they say you can't be your parents, you can't be your friends. So who are you going to have make your call for you? Is it going to be your boss at the Pizza Hut you worked at during high school or during college? Is it going to be your high school coach when you're, you know, graduating college? It's probably going to be your coach. And now if you're graduating high school, then it is going to be your high school coach. So if you're a player, are you a leader? Are you involved? Do you sit the front of the classroom? Did you get good grades? Did you show up early to the gym? Did you come into the coach's office and look at game film? Did you come into the coach's office and ask what you can do to be better? What can the team do to be better? Because I'm a college coach and you're a high school player. And your high school coach calls me and says, I have little Johnny here and he's really good and he's a leader and he's all those things I just said. You guys should take him. And so I bring him in and he's good and I take him. And he ends up being okay, but he's not a leader. He's not a guy who sits in the front of the class and gets great grades and all these things I just mentioned. So now the next year, the next player comes through and this coach calls me again and says, Coach, I got a guy and he's this and this and this. Well, I'm going to say, you know what, Coach? Last year you sent me this guy. You put your reputation on the line and he wasn't that good. And he wasn't the guy you said he was going to be. So now I'm really probably not interested in this guy because you've ruined your reputation. I wouldn't say that to him, but that's what I would be thinking in my head. So if you want, as a high school player, your coach to go to bat for you, then you got to do those extra things. And the same thing is for a college player. If you have a college player and he says, Coach, I want to play overseas. Okay, I played overseas. The American who plays overseas has to be a leader. He has to be able to carry that team on his back. He has to be the leading scorer, the best defender, guard the American on the other team. You know, if you're in a big club and he's the face of the club. He is the leader. It's his job. He has to be there first. He has to lift weights. He has to do every single thing to carry a team or they'll send you home and they'll find somebody else who will. So if my college player wants me to put my reputation on the line and recommend him to an agent or a team overseas, Well, then he's going to have to earn that, because I don't want to just have my name ruined so that next time when I have a player, they won't even listen to me because I've sent him a guy who wasn't what I said he was or wasn't as good as I wanted. So as a player, your sponsor is probably going to be your coach, right? Who else do you have in your life that can write a letter for you? I mean, those of us who play basketball, it's our whole life. So who else would write a letter for you other than your coach, or make a phone call for you other than your coach? There's really not very many people outside of your family and friends. And the same thing goes for a job. If my player is a senior and he wants a job as a person in business, and he shows up late sometimes, and he doesn't, you know, we have a Zoom call and he kind of doesn't participate. He's not locked in. He's watching TV in the background. He's texting the whole time. And that employer calls, you know, wants me to call him and say, hey, is this guy a leader? Is this guy a great teammate? Is this a guy who gets here first and gets his work done and stays late? What am I supposed to do now? The answer is no. So you need to work on that. So everybody, players need to work on that. Now, let's talk about as a coach. You're a coach. You're an assistant coach at a high school level or at a college level, and you want to move on up to being a head coach. Well, when we have a Zoom call, are you locked in? You know, we had a Zoom call, like I just mentioned, and my assistant coach, one didn't show up, and the other one had his camera off the whole time. Does that show that he's interested? Does that show that he's bought in and he wants everything he can get out of this program? You show up for practice early. Do you call me and say, coach, you know, how are we doing? You know, and in this TED talk, the lady said, not only should you spend time with your job, but you should spend time with your sponsor, making a great relationship with them so they will go to bat for you in the room or on a phone call or on a letter of rec. So you're almost like networking your own head coach, networking with your own head coach, right? Because the more time you spend with the head coach, the more you show him your talent for coaching, your knowledge for coaching, the more you spend time with the players, the more you spend time on the floor, in the office, watching film. What you're doing is you're building your resume, not on a piece of paper, but in the mind of your head coach. So now when you say, coach, there's a job opportunity over here and I'm really interested in it, do you mind writing me a letter? Do you mind making a phone call on my behalf? Coach's gonna be, heck yeah. You've been done a great job. You've worked your butt off. You've done all these things. Of course I'm gonna do that. Versus a coach who goes, yeah, all right. And then they write you a half-assed letter and they, you know, maybe make a phone call or they'll wait for the person to call you and they'll say, yeah, he did a good job, you know. But those people will know that he's not endorsing you so highly. You want him to get on that phone and have your back and make sure that person knows that you're the guy. And the only way you're going to get that is if you earn it. And the same goes with an athletic director. The same goes with anyone you meet, you know. You want to make such a good impression and build a bond with that person and build chemistry with that person and build rapport with that person so that they may go to bat for you down the road. And I just thought it was really interesting to listen to, and I think it's so important. And if you're a head coach, you want to have that rapport with your athletic director. You want to have that rapport with your other head coaches. You know, every campus that I've gone to, as an assistant coach and a head coach, I go to all the sports. I go watch the soccer games. I watch the volleyball games. I watch the baseball games. I watch the softball games. I watch everything. Not only just because I love sports, but because, number one, I want to show that I'm bought into this school. I want to show all the other coaches that I'm interested in their program, so hopefully they'll be interested in mine. I want to build relationships with them. If somebody in the office needs some help with something, I'll volunteer to help. And I'm not doing it to BS. I'm not doing it just to kiss ass or whatever. I'm doing it because that's what being bought in does. And down the road, maybe it'll pay off for me, and maybe it won't. But if it doesn't, I don't care, because that's the way I am, and that's the way you should be. You got to buy in on all levels so that maybe sometime that will pay off. Finally, we'll get to the strategy session, and what I want to talk about today is using the advantage of a ball screen. And as I mentioned in the beginning, we're using a very heavy ball screen offense, and our goal in that ball screen offense is to make the defender go over the screen. And look, if he goes under the screen, that's fine. It doesn't hurt our offense, but we want to make him go over the screen because now he's chasing. And now, even if it's just for a second or two, we're five against four, right? Because this guy is behind our guy with the ball. So he is going to be chasing us, and now we have an advantage. So the important part after that is to use that advantage. But so if you watch something like soccer or even basketball, any kind of team sport where there's a man-to-man situation, and I know soccer, you play a little bit of zone, but kind of everyone has a man. And so what happens is if – let's just go back to basketball, right? If I go for a steal and I hit that lane and I miss, my man that just caught the ball because I missed, now it's five against four. That's correct, right? So a different defender has to come up and guard that guy. Now that's going to open up somebody else. And then a different defender is going to have to rotate to that guy, and that opens up somebody else, and so on and so forth. So it's the same situation when you make a guy come over the top of a ball screen. If you come over the top of, if the defender comes over the top of a ball screen, we're on offense, we're five against four, and now if this guy's behind us, well, we can keep going to the basket until somebody else picks us up. And if somebody, when somebody else picks us up, then that means one of my teammates has to be open because a guy had to leave his man to come pick up the ball. So now that guy's open. So now we look for a pass there, and now this guy's open. So now he might have a shot, and if he doesn't have a shot, he's got an attack. And now a different defender is going to have to come up to him. And what's that going to do? It's going to open up another guy. And so the way we're trying to run this offense is to take advantage of that, which is when a guy – when we get this guy to come over the top of the ball screen, that's going to have the defender here – our guy here, and now someone else has to come up, and now this pass is going to be open. And now maybe this guy slides over, and now this pass of the corner is open. And so what we're getting is a lot of easy layups, a lot of wide open shots, because we have that man advantage. And what we end up having is this defense scrambling to catch up the entire time. And then what happens if they do catch up? Well, then we set another ball screen. And if they go under it, then we set another ball screen. And then we set another ball screen until they go over the top. And when they go over the top, we use our advantage again. And it's a lot of skill work that we're doing, and it's definitely still getting better, but I can see it working. And I think the hardest part, you know, right now is with so many new guys, and I mean with so many guys, everyone wants to show their place on the team. And so we're not hitting the open guy because this guy comes off a screen, he's kind of open. And or he's got a big guy that steps to help and he tries to take him off the dribble or shoot in his face, and we're getting some bad shots because guys want to show, hey coach, look at me, I can score, look at me, I'm one of the best players, blah blah blah. But it's a process, and if we can get these guys to become super unselfish, then we're going to get all the open shots we want because of that advantage that we're creating by a player going over the top. And it's funny to me because I've always wanted players to go over the top, but with this offense, it's amazing because as the guy does go over the top, you create this huge advantage. And not only do you get mismatches where a big guy usually has to come to the point guard coming off the screen, but you also get, you know, sometimes that guy who was guarding the screen will just switch onto the big guy. And now we have another mismatch where we have a guard against one of our bigs who can now roll to the basket, and we can work the ball around and try to get a mismatch inside. So, you know, if your team is setting ball screens, the goal, in my opinion, should be to get them over the top. Now, if you have a knockdown shooter, then you want to set the ball screen high so you can have the defender go under it and shoot that three. And I think, you know, if you go back to episode one, I talked about screen angles. And I know that was a long time ago, but the screen angle is so important. And we've actually done drills just on screen angles. And when we get this screen angle right, it puts the defender in such a bad spot. Because of the angle, if the defender wants to go under, he has to run this huge loop around our guy and then, you know, in theory, around their, you know, the screener's defender. And if he wants to go over, now we have our advantage. And it doesn't really matter how they guard the screen because, and we're actually, this is something that we're doing too. We're actually kind of teaching our team how to guard a screen every way so that we can practice going against everything they might throw at us. And there's a lot. I mean, going under, going over the top, hedging, switching, trapping, icing, dropping back, whatever the case may be. I mean, there's so many ways to guard a ball screen showing. And we're trying to go over all of them. But no matter what we do, we want to get this guy to go over the screen. And so I don't think anyone really goes under screens anymore, like completely. And if you do, if teams do, then what do you start doing? You just start setting the screen lower and lower. And at some point you get low enough that the guy's got to go over the screen. So I really think that this is something that can be put in easily. It's not putting in a whole offense. It's putting in a better screen angle and having your screeners, because that's the most important part. The screeners determine whether the guy goes over or under, because where the screener sets it, the angle, etc., that determines what a lot of times what the guy guarding the ball does. So if you can get your screeners to set these screens low and at great screen angles and force the guy guarding the ball to go over the screen a lot, you're going to create tons of advantages and open shots and open players. And look, the numbers are obvious. When you're open, you shoot a really high percentage. When you're contested, you shoot a really low percentage. And that's what where your percentage comes in. So the more open shots you can get, the more your team is going to score. And I personally think that, you know, getting these offensive guys, I mean, getting these defenders to go over the screen is just going to open all that up. And then from there, it's up to you to put your guys in the right positions where they can catch and score or catch and shoot or catch and redrive and whatever the case may be for your personal team. So that's kind of what we're doing right now. And I really like how it's going. And I think it's we're going to keep working on it every day. And I think it's going to keep getting better. So that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next time.